I'm just telling him, okay, yes, baby. There are many kids that they don't have their parents.
Let's take a look at one more short clip before we bring you back in, Layla.
Fault Lines has collected the names of 33 children killed in the war. Most lost their lives in their homes on the first night of the conflict. On the third day of the war, Israel bombed Tehran's Quds Square, killing 18 people, including a pregnant woman and a 16-year-old child. Iran retaliated with missiles and drones. 32 died in Israel, but Iran's toll was far heavier. 1,064 killed and thousands more injured.
Harrowing.
Layla, talk about why you and your colleagues were motivated to make this film and what you think people should take away from it.
Well, I think it's really important to show people the human impact of war, wherever it may be. And with the Western media, there's always this kind of hierarchy of life that we see. We're constantly told that Israeli life is worth more than Palestinian life or Iranian life or really any other life in the region, that Western white lives are worth more. And those are the lives that are worth covering. As Edward Said put it, the kind of the human density and detail of life, right? Really sitting down and understanding who these people are. We don't really see that much in media coverage, but especially Western media coverage of Iranians. So I think it was very important to really capture the human cost of Israel's brutal attacks in Iran. More than 1,000 people were killed over that 12-day period, including our team was able to find the names of 33 children who were killed. And many of them were killed on that first night on June 13th, when Israel was indiscriminately attacking residential buildings. The vast majority of the people were killed in their beds as they slept, which is, you can argue, a blatant war crime to just attack civilians like that. Israel claims that their targets were nuclear scientists, but even if that's the case, that's still illegal because under international humanitarian law, you can't attack civilians unless they're directly involved in hostilities. It was very important that we cover this, that we show what people went through. The team found that people in Iran are still very much fearful of another attack because Israel keeps threatening to do that. They feel like they want to be heard. We saw also, the team saw Hind Hassan, my sister Lamel Arian, also was a producer on the film, the horrifying impact of sanctions in Iran. Iranians, you know, this family, the grandfather and aunt of two-year-old Rayan, who's the youngest child killed in Israel's assault, talked about the fact that the sanctions meant that they couldn't even get something as simple as antibiotics. The machines in the hospitals were old and malfunctioning. They believe that their own family members, the mother, father, and two-month-old that were killed because of the sanctions, because they could have gotten treatment and saved their lives from those severe burns, but they didn't. This is, of course, a story that we've seen repeated over and over again in Gaza. A lot of the Iranians that they spoke with also brought up Gaza. You know, they said this is repeating some of the same patterns we've seen in Gaza. And they also brought up kind of Western hypocrisy when it comes to human rights. Trita Parsi, who's an analyst with the Quincy Institute, who appears in the film, talked about how one of the objectives of this assault by Israel was to bring in the U.S. into a war with Iran, which they succeeded, to decapitate the regime, which was a failure, and also to turn Iran into a place like Lebanon, like Syria, that they could just, like Gaza, that they could just bomb at will over and over again. The team also looked at the deadliest strike of that 12-day assault, which was on Evin prison, which the West likes to point to all the time, of a symbol of oppression. And that's the language that Israel used. It's a symbol of oppression, and that's why we bombed it, which is logic that I struggle to kind of understand what that means. But more than 50 people were killed. They bombed it during the busiest time of the day, during visiting hours, killing at least one child, killing a lawyer, killing an accountant named Maryam, whose story we tell through the testimony of her brother, who actually arrived at the scene. So I think it's just really important that people watch it and share it to understand what it means to attack a country like this.
Of course, it's called Target Tehran, and it's from Fault Lines on Al Jazeera. I want to show this clip of Hind Hassan trying to confront U.S. Republican Senator Tom Tillis about the human toll of the war that you make so visible in this film. Let's watch that.
Went to Alaska and went back and bombed and killed innocent Ukrainian citizens.
Senator, you spoke about Russians bombing Ukrainian civilians. What about Iranian civilians? I went to Iran and I spoke to a lot of family members who lost people.
My position on Iran is simple. Until there's regime change, Iran is a malign actor. And I feel terribly for the Iranian people. I work a lot with various movements that are against the Mullahs, but they're a cancer.
Would you say that to the grandpa, the father of 12-year-old?
Say it to you, and I would say it to anybody else. The Iranian people need to be freed from the mullahs, but there is no place. In the same way, there is no place for Hamas in Gaza. There is no place for the mullahs in Iran.
So this is about government change? It's about changing the government, and it's not about
regime change.
Well, there you have it.
There you have it.
What are your thoughts when you hear something like that? I mean,
I was with Hind on the Hill when we filmed that scene. What makes it really shocking is that we say over and over again, to the point of actually it feeling boring, how much of a double standard there is when it comes to Western politicians, journalists, you know, political analysts, what have you, when it comes to this hierarchy of life we talk about. You see it right there. I mean, it unfolded before our eyes where he blasted Putin for killing Ukrainian civilians. He called him a liar. He said Trump shouldn't believe anything he says. And then Hind asks him, well, you just spoke about Ukrainian civilians. What about Iranian civilians? He just completely ignores her question, dismisses it, talks about the quote unquote mullahs, and admits that to him, this is about actually regime change, changing the government, as if that's ever turned out well for anybody. And it's just really stunning, the callousness, the lack of humanity, the complete disconnect between these very callous, harsh statements showing zero concern for human life and the rhetoric, the kind of, you know, militaristic, threatening rhetoric that he has. And it just shows this complete hypocrisy, helps nobody. People see right through it. And all it shows is and uncovers is their massive hypocrisy.
Yeah. Leila, let's turn to Palestine now. And Reporters Without Borders declared that for the third year in a row, Israel has been, by leaps and bounds, the world's biggest killer of journalists. Their figures are an undercount, but even this mainstream organization has to acknowledge it. And at the same time, we're seeing coverage of Gaza fade from the headlines in the Western media. You know, they're like, well, there's a ceasefire, so we don't have to cover it anymore. We all follow your social media postings about your critique, very righteous critiques of the media coverage. What strikes you or angers you about what you're seeing right now?
What we've seen time and time again is the normalization of the killing of Palestinians, whether it was well before October 7th, when 2023 was the deadliest year for Palestinians in many years, or well after this so-called ceasefire, where Israel continues to kill Palestinians in the most horrifying ways, entire buildings collapsing in Gaza, which we can all see a mile away, that when you inflict that much destruction on a place, all of these structures are very unstable and can kill people desperate for shelter at any moment. We're seeing that happen. We're seeing people being killed in their tents through flooding. And I hold Israel, and any human being should hold Israel accountable for every single one of these deaths, because Israel has created all of these conditions to cause death, whether it's the continued deaths from malnutrition, lack of food, prisoners still dying in custody, prisoners being rearrested who were released under the ceasefire, toddlers being killed next to this so-called yellow, invisible yellow line. So we see, again, every single one of these stories should be worthy of coverage. But when they're not covered, the editorial argument or line that they're having is that the killing of Palestinians is simply not newsworthy. That comes from a deep dehumanization of Palestinians. It comes from structural bias that we see. It's not just individual bias, it's structural bias built into these institutions. And what it does is it leads to a less informed public and continued suffering for Palestinians. It's shameful, it's a dereliction of duty, And I think it's why there's such massive mistrust of these institutions at a time when they're really desperately trying to claw back the narrative and trying to consolidate their control over that narrative.
Leila, the trends that you're pointing out are ones that we've all been able to observe for decades. I mean, I started my work not doing journalism, but doing media criticism. So these are trends that have been visible to me for 30 years. Did you expect, should we have expected the last 2 years to have changed things?
It's a good question. I mean, I think it's important to remember that the very people running these newsrooms, so the management that kind of sets the tone for how these stories are covered and approached, oftentimes come from the same milieu as the policymakers, the people like Tom Tillis, who show a complete lack of compassion and humanity towards Palestinians. So oftentimes they come from kind of that same ideological approach and background of dehumanizing Palestinians or rendering them invisible. Or as Bill Clinton said at the Council for Foreign Relations, he basically said, I think it was Sarah Leah Whitson from Dawn, former Human Rights Watch, tweeted out his remarks about how if only Palestinians, you know, weren't an issue, Arabs just want to do business and be happy. Essentially, he's saying if only Palestinians didn't exist, the world would be a better place. I mean, these kinds of attitudes, unfortunately, cut across society, whether it's people making policy or running the country or running these newsrooms. And there are people within the newsrooms who are pushing for better coverage, who wish that things could be better. But I think Israel also denying them access to Gaza to see for themselves. Of course, Palestinian journalists who've been killed, as you mentioned, in record numbers, have done heroic work exposing the brutality of the genocide. But I do think if people were on the ground and were able to see for themselves, and we're talking about people who actually see Palestinians as human beings, I think the coverage would have been different if they were able to kind of push through the censorship that we're seeing.
Leila, you conjured up some evil spirits when you mentioned Bill Clinton. And the other spirit you conjured up is Mrs. Clinton, Hillary Clinton. And she's been back in the news recently as well, blaming social media for the incredibly negative views that young Americans, in fact, now a majority of all Americans, have about Israel after watching more than 2 years of live stream genocide of babies and children and elders being blown to pieces by Israel. And she spoke at the recent conference hosted by Israel Hayom, the newspaper owned by Israeli-American billionaire Miriam Adelson. Here's what Hillary Clinton said at that recent Israel Hayom summit.
Young people from our own country, from around the world, where were they getting their information? They were getting their information from social media, particularly TikTok. That is where they were learning about what happened on October 7th, what happened in the, you know, days, weeks, and months to follow. That's a serious problem. It's a serious problem for democracy, whether it's Israel or the United States, and it's a serious problem for our young people. And it was frankly shocking to me how little the students we were encountering, not only in this class we teach, which is a very large class, international relations about crisis decision making, but students more generally. And that's why I mentioned the social media piece of it, because when you would try to talk to them to engage in some kind of reasonable discussion, it was very difficult because they did not know history. They had very little context. And what they were being told on social media was not just one-sided, it was pure propaganda.
I mean, the thing to take away from that is it's social media sharing propaganda. So she actually says pure propaganda when she's talking about the images we've seen of the horrors actually going on Gaza. She's calling that propaganda. Now, there was another clip, which I'm not going to show, and it's from a few weeks back, where in addition to blaming TikTok, she blames the Chinese Communist Party for the fact that young people in America don't love Israel, don't love seeing people carrying the remains of their children around in plastic shopping bags. She blames the Chinese Communist Party, not Israel, for that, not the United States that supplied the bombs. That's another clip I won't show you, but I do want to show you this clip of our colleague, Aaron Maté from the Gray Zone, who had an opportunity to confront Hillary Clinton just a few days ago at the Doha Forum in Qatar. Let's take a look at that.
Hi, Secretary Clinton. Secretary Clinton, I can ask a question. I'm a journalist with the Gray Zone. Can I ask you, you said at the Israel Hayom Summit that young people are brainwashed because of social media. What about young people who just don't want to see U.S.-made bombs kill Palestinians? Any message for them?
I mean, what can you say? It's entrenched depravity. She plays a role.
Yeah, she plays a big role. But Leila, feel free to comment on Hillary Clinton. But more broadly, what does this discourse tell us about how elites in the United States and the West more generally are reacting to the genocide? And, you know, we're seeing more and more efforts to restrict social media. Australia's ban on social media for teenagers is now being cited as a model. Of course, it's all being talked about, we want to protect vulnerable young people from the bad influences of social media. Of course, we saw the Zionist takeover of major legacy media outlets like CBS News. Can all that succeed? Can this genie be put back in the bottle? I mean, can anything rescue Israel? Just your thoughts.
I think this is coming from a place of pure panic on their part. I mean, you saw also Sarah Hurwitz, former Obama speechwriter, saying, how can I speak to young people through a wall of dead children, which is one of the most, I would say, like callous statements I've ever heard, completely dehumanizing statements. So when they talk about social media, let's break down, what are they actually talking about? They're talking about videos taken in Gaza that are completely unfiltered, unsanitized, and completely out of their control. They can't control what other people are filming in Gaza and posting online and what young people are seeing, which again is unfiltered, unedited, horrifying footage that we simply can't erase from our minds. How many people remember that horrific image? I think it was during the Super Bowl in January 2024 of that young girl who was like impaled on a fence. How many people can't forget the horrifying image of Shaaban al-Dalu burning alive, hooked up to an IV, of these human stories of little Reem, soul of my soul, of Dr. Rifat al-Ar'ir, you know, all of these people who were taken, the tens of thousands of children, the child amputees. We've seen and we've heard things, I mean, let alone the sounds of people screaming. We've heard and seen things that we will never, ever forget. And they are in pure panic that what that's translated to is that Israel's favorability ratings have gone down and there's far less support in both parties and across all age groups, although the oldest people, you know, are the least likely to change. This is the boomer generation that both Hillary and Bill Clinton belong to. But this is coming from a place of pure panic, feeling like they've lost the narrative and wanting to claim it back. And I think it's going to take, you know, a lot of effort to erase people's minds after watching a live stream genocide for 2 years. But we are seeing these efforts to control TikTok, to control the algorithm, to continue shadow banning, to erase the work of journalists in Gaza, removing their social media accounts. Thankfully, we know of efforts to preserve that social media content. I think it's going to fail because I think it's impossible to erase what we've all seen. And these opinions have already turned and changed. Barry Weiss taking control of CBS. Who really watches CBS? I think it's people above the age of 70s, like their average demographic. It's not a powerful medium anymore. It's lost its allure. You have YouTube streamers who bring in far more views than CBS. I don't think they'll succeed, but I think they're going to pour millions and millions of dollars into trying to reclaim that narrative. And it's up to people of conscience. It's up to professional journalists who actually care about the integrity of this work to insist that people not forget and to continue telling stories rooted in fact and reality. What I find really interesting is Hillary Clinton loves to condescend. She condescends to young people about how they don't have the context. What possible context can justify the killing of tens of thousands of children, of innocent people, of civilians? I don't understand. I mean, what is she actually saying? And this is why people, it's really backfired, by the way. I don't think anybody buys what she's selling. What possible context can justify the crimes that we've all seen Israel commit on live stream? It just, doesn't make any sense. And I think, I forget which right winger went on Twitter and said, they want to silence Sarah Hurwitz. It's like, no, people want her to keep speaking as much as possible. Yes. Because she's the absolute best spokesperson for this horrific ideology that just justifies the killing of innocent people over and over and over again. So I think the more they speak, the more they reveal themselves and their lack of humanity.
I've seen people talking about how as Israel and its lobby realize that they've lost the narrative and that they're not going to be able to, you know, Israel invented cherry tomatoes away this genocide. So probably the consultancies, the PR agencies, the pollsters are saying, look, we're not going to be able to greenwash and pinkwash and tech wash this genocide away and make people love Israel again. Eurovision, the song contest, which is a big forum for marketing Israel as fun and progressive and youth friendly and all of that, that's torn apart. Four countries have already announced they're boycotting it because of Israel is being allowed to participate this year. So I'm seeing concern, or I'm seeing people talking about how Israel and its lobby really leaning into Islamophobia and anti-Muslim incitement and, you know, the West versus barbaric Islam strategy, which is not new, but they're trying to revive it. Are you seeing that? And do you think that would work?
I'm absolutely seeing it. It's all over social media. It's content that's being actively promoted. I mean, the owner of X is one of the primary people pushing this over and over and over again, Elon Musk. I don't know that it will work. I mean, Islamophobia has long been a tactic that's been pushed by Israel to kind of incite against Palestinians, but the Muslim world at large, and kind of deflect attention from its own oppression of Palestinians, its own crimes against people throughout the region. I think that remains to be seen, but it's definitely something that we're seeing more and more of being pushed on social media platforms. So I think it's something that people need to be kind of like have media literacy about and reject.
A few months ago, you and Fault Lines broadcast an episode called The Disappearance of Dr. Abu Safiya. This is another story that has been completely buried and ignored in legacy media. This is, of course, the physician, pediatrician, and the director of Kamal Adwan Hospital in Beit Lahia in northern Gaza, who was abducted by Israeli forces almost exactly a year ago. Israeli forces raided the hospital again. This time they arrested Abu Safiya. And Dr. Abu Safiya is still being held by Israel under its so-called unlawful combatant laws, along with thousands of other Palestinians from Gaza, including many healthcare workers. He's being subjected to systematic abuse and torture on top of dealing with the grief of everything and everyone that he has lost, including his son, including his colleagues, including his place of work and his patients. Leila, what can you tell us about Dr. Abu Safiya's situation right now? And what are your reflections as the first anniversary of his abduction approaches?
Well, Israel, as we know, holds Palestinian captives under horrific conditions. They deny them medical care. They don't allow them to speak with their family members. They barely get a chance to see their attorneys. And as you mentioned, he's being held under this so-called unlawful combatant law, which basically denies them any justice or due process. He isn't facing any charges. They have these trials or court proceedings on the phone. I mean, it's none of it would, you know, stand up to any measure of, you know, a respectable, you know, legitimate court in any country. But I think what's important is why they're doing this, both to him and to the other medical professionals that they've taken captive. And that's to punish them for daring to try to keep Gaza alive, to keep the hospitals running. The whole plan was to empty out northern Gaza, and Kamal Adwan Hospital was standing in their way, the way of that plan, because it represented life and it represented a place that was saving lives. And that's why the hospital was targeted, the medical staff were targeted, and that's why he was targeted. And as his former lawyer, Raed Qasim, says in the film, Israel likes to discipline us. They like to take our role models and make an example out of them. And that was another reason he was targeted, to make an example out of anybody who dares keep hope alive, who dares save lives in Gaza, and who dares refuse them, because he had so many possibilities, so many options to leave. His wife is from Kazakhstan, so he easily could have left and gone to Kazakhstan at many points. And the reason they punished him is because he refused to leave time and time and time again when they kept threatening him, even after they killed his son, even after they injured him. And that was his only crime. You know, just as they set the record for the highest number of journalists killed in Gaza, they've set the record for medical workers killed, humanitarian workers, UN workers. I mean, they've broken every record of these categories. Of course, we know that the largest cohort of child amputees as well.
Yeah.
And what's terrifying is we know that Dr. Adnan El-Borsh was likely tortured to death in Israeli custody. So, I mean, Dr. Hossam Abu Safiya's situation is grave. December 27th will mark 1 year since his abduction. And it's very important that people speak out. I mean, we hope they screen this film in order to raise awareness of his situation, of his case. We've heard from some healthcare workers around the world that they're interested in screening it and continuing the conversation. One of the things that kind of you hang on to that gives you hope is that after he was essentially taken hostage by Israel last December, there was a big campaign of healthcare workers all over the world who called for his release. Of course, on that same note, there are complaints among healthcare workers that their industry and their field has been silent on this horrifying figure of 1,700 medical workers killed, many hundreds in custody, being held under horrific conditions for no reason other than being medical workers.
I'm so grateful to you and your team, Leila, for making that incredible film about Dr. Hossam Abu Safiya. It's necessary, yeah, as you say, to document these things. But just the brazenness of the attacks on hospitals, so deliberate, so intentional, so cruel. And all of that is documented in this film, The Disappearance of Dr. Abu Safiya. Leila, thank you for your extraordinary work. Will you come back again soon and continue the conversation?
Absolutely. Thank you both so much, and to the entire EI team for everything you do. Thank you.
That was Al Jazeera's Fault Lines executive producer, Leila El-Aryan. Thank you for tuning into Electronic Intifada Radio. I'm Nora Barrows-Friedman. For more interviews, reports, and analysis, along with feature articles, podcasts, and our live stream, check out electronicintifada.net. Produced by Pierre Loisel, Nora Barrows-Friedman, and Tamara Nassar. The Electronic Intifada is a program service of the Middle East Cultural and Charitable Society, Incorporated, a 501c3 nonprofit organization.
You're listening to CJSF 90.1 FM, and we hope you have a great holiday season.
I'm Dr. Anthony Lizowitz, and this is Climate Connections. In April, volunteers gathered at Elijah Perry Park in Camden, New Jersey, to plant trees. The event kicked off We Grow Camden, an initiative to plant 3,000 trees across the city over the next few years.
A ton of residents stopped through to not just ask what we were doing, but to thank us for doing it. We shared food. We gave away some shade trees for folks that wanted to plant, you know, in front of their home. Yeah, it was a really beautiful day.
Justin Dennis is with the Trust for Public Land, one of the groups leading the project. He says in many low-income Camden neighborhoods, trees are few and far between. So the sun beats down on dark surfaces like pavement that absorb heat, making those areas much hotter than leafier suburbs nearby. Trees help cool cities by providing shade and pulling heat out of the air, and they also filter air pollution and soak up stormwater. So We Grow Camden will help reforest the city and train local residents to care for the trees as they grow.
Trees that are well-maintained along a block or within a community, they tell a story that a community matters, right? And that its future is worth nurturing. It's not just taking care of what's important today, but looking forward in that 50 and 70 years to say, hey, this is your place, stay here.
Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. To learn more about climate change, visit climateconnections.org.